Thank you so much, Shira, and it's wonderful to be here learning with Torah in Motion, and to see some familiar faces and some new faces in the audience. So everyone who joins with their screen, it's an addition. We feels like we're a bit more together. So hi everyone, and as Shira said, this is part of a series on adversaries in Jewish tradition. We're going to be looking at three different, I guess you could call them adversaries or enemies in some sense, of the Jewish people throughout history. That really they're it's very seasonal that we're discussing it now for reasons that will become clear in a moment. So today we're going to be looking at Megillas Antiochus, about, of course, the Hanukkah story, Antiochus. That's very timely. Hanukkah is just a couple days away. And the next two meetings, the next two Thursdays, we're going to be looking at a text called Todos Yeshu, or the history of Yeshua, of Jesus, which is seasonal for two reasons, both because December 25th is coming up, and because, according to Jewish tradition, Paul's Yahrzeit is coming up. Why that matters or is of interest, you'll have to come back in 2 weeks to learn more about that. But it's Tes Teves, according to some sources in Jewish tradition. In any event, our goal will be to look at these two texts that are somewhat neglected. You probably don't study them in day school, I'm guessing. They're not your average, they're not sort of classical texts, but they're actually really important and really interesting in terms of how Jews throughout history, the Jews, those who wrote these texts and those who read them, including reading them ritually as a religious act. We'll talk about this in a minute. Throughout Jewish history, how they thought about these characters. They thought about Antiochus, how they thought about Yeshu and Paul. So that's our plan for the next 3 weeks. And today we're starting with Megillas Antiochus. And one thing that's interesting, just looking at the name of it, is it's named after both of these texts, really. Today, focusing on our topic for today, it's named after Antiochus, right? We don't often name, Jewish texts after the bad guy, so to speak. But this is, and as well as Toldos Yeshu, these are some exceptions to the rule. So we're going to be talking a little bit about what these texts are, and the history, how they've been used in different Jewish communities, and then do a little bit of a textual analysis in each case, because talking in theory is always nice, but really getting into these texts, and I think I'm guessing for most people here for the first time to really get a chance to read these texts, I think there's a real payoff to that. So first, before we get into the text, let's talk about what this text is not, because you may be thinking, oh, I think I know, I think I've heard of this. Chances are you may be thinking of something else. Let me just share the screen for a moment. And let me adjust this so I can see more of you. The Gemara talks about one of the differences between Purim and Chanukah, without going into too much detail here, but it talks about Esther as compared to Shachar, to the morning, because Ma Shachar Sof Kol HaLaila, Af Esther Sof Kol HaNisim. Just like the morning is the end of the night, Esther is the end of all miracles. And what does that mean? Esther's the end of miracles. B'ha'ika Chanukah. What about Chanukah? What about the miracles of Chanukah? Aren't those considered miracles too? Asks the Gemara, and that happened after the Purim story, after Esther. No, the Gemara answers, Nitna lichtov kamrina. We're talking about miracles that can be written down. And even though all of these miracles happened on Chanukah, they weren't meant to be written down, at least not the same way that the Purim miracles were meant to be written down. What does this mean? This means that Megillas Esther is part of Tanakh, right? And that's because it's supposed to be. The Gemara is saying it's supposed to be part of Tanakh. It was the miracles happened in such a way that they were supposed to be written down and included in Torah Shebichtav, in the written Torah. But the miracles of Chanukah were not meant to be written down. They took place. Hashem caused those miracles to happen. But there's not supposed to be a text, certainly not a text of Tanakh, about the miracles of Chanukah. That being said, I think many of us have heard of different texts and can think of different texts that discuss the miracles that happened on Chanukah. Do people, feel free to shout out, unmute yourself and say, where do we know about, what are texts that tell us the Chanukah story?
1 Maccabees.
Okay, the first book of Maccabees, there's actually four different books of Maccabees, but the first book of Maccabees tells the, among other things, tells the Chanukah story And that we only have that in Greek. It probably was written in Hebrew, but we only have the Greek version. But, you know, so that's obviously not part of Tanakh, at least certainly not the Jewish Tanakh. Certain Christians included in their canon in some way, but it's definitely not part of Tanakh. But it is an account of what happened, and it was written really, the second century BCE, close to when the events happened. So that's one text. That's not what we're discussing. Sometimes people confuse Megillas Antiochus with the Book of Maccabees. They're not the same thing, and we're not going to be studying the Book of Maccabees. We're studying Megillas Antiochus. What are other texts that we know about the Hanukkah story from?
Shabbat, Masechet Shabbat.
Right. The rest of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos talks about the story, and that may be the most well-known account, and it focuses on the miracle of the there was only enough oil for one night, and it lasted for 8 nights. That's sort of the centerpiece of the story in the Gemara, and that explains why we have 8 nights of Hanukkah. Great. Where else? What are other depictions, classical depictions of the Hanukkah story?
Josephus,
the historian Josephus from the first century CE, he tells a version of the story as well. Wonderful. Anything else?
Al-Anisim,
the text of Al-Anisim, right? Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochan, Kohen Gadol Hashmonai Yevanav, right? The story of Matisyahu gives a basic summary of the story and focusing on the war rather than on the miracle of the light. Anything else? Anyone have any other ones?
Megillas Tanis.
Okay, Megillas Tanis, which we'll talk about in a minute in one of the sources, which is it's a list of days on which one cannot fast. And one of those days was Hanukkah, and it gave a little history of Hanukkah, and there's different versions of this. There's like the short version, and there's a lengthened version that has some interesting parallels to the Gemara and Shabbos. But I think you guys did a great job. These are basically all of the classical, let's say the pre-medieval sources about and Al-Anisim may just be medieval. It's not exactly clear. It's quoted by the Gaonim. That's the first source we have of it. When it was written, we don't exactly know. But those are basically the classical sources of the Hanukkah story. And then we have our text. We have Megillas Antiochus. And again, despite the fact that the Gemara says it's not part of Tanakh, we don't have a book about the miracle of Hanukkah that becomes part of Tanakh. We do have this Megillas Antiochus. And we'll see, in some ways, it could appear, it looks similar to a Tanakh work. It's written in Aramaic. Right. Of course, Tanakh is written in most of it in Hebrew, but some books of Tanakh are in Aramaic. So it's not written in Greek, right? Like the Book of Maccabees. It's obvious. You look at the Book of Maccabees, at least in its current form, you'd never put that in Tanakh because it's in Greek. But Megillas Antiochus, maybe, you know, it looks similar to Tanakh in certain ways. Let's look at, and just I'll mention that the name Megillas Antiochus, that is the name, the primary name that people use. But there also are other names that have been given to this work. Sefer B'nei Hashmonai, right, the book of the sons of the Hasmonean, Megillas Beis Hashmonai, the scroll of the house of the Hasmonean. So there are other names for it, but we're gonna call it Megillas Antiochus, the standard name. Let's take a look at some early sources that talk about this work, and we'll start. We'll jump over source 2 for a second. Look at source number 3, the Sefer Halachos Gedolos, the Bahag by Rav Shimon Kayar in the 9th century Babylonia. So he tells us about this text. He says, Zikne beis Shammai v'zikne beis Hillel, the elders of the house of Shammai, the house of Hillel, heim kasvu Megillas beis Hashmonai, or he has a different name for it. But he says, they wrote this scroll of the house of the Hasmoneans, the Anashav lo ala ledoros, and we never really set this as permanent, Achiyamot koin le'urim v'tumim, until we have a high priest with the urim v'tumim to be able to set this as either a biblical book or maybe a holiday, but we don't have the authority to do that now, which is interesting. Because presumably they were keeping Hanukkah then, so it seems like maybe he's talking about the book not being canonized. And he says, "V'heim kasvu Megillas Tanis." They also wrote Megillas Tanis, which Jake just mentioned a minute ago, and it gives a little bit of the story based in the Gemara about Elias Chanina ben Chizkiah ben Garon Shalul Levakar. They went to visit their friend in his attic, and they wrote Megillas Tanis back then. This is a long time ago, Beishamai Beis Hillel. That's like the first century CE. So he says they wrote it. Now there are some issues with this source. I think I saw someone wrote that of all the manuscripts of the Bahag, this only appears in one of them. All the other ones talk about Megillas Tanis, but not about Megillas Beis Hashmonai. So there may or may not be a citation of our work of Megillas Beis Hashmonai in the 9th century, but certainly we know it's quoted and discussed extensively in the 10th century in source number two by Rav Sadia Gaon in his Sefer HaGali, his introduction, he says, Ukmo, Shekasu, B'nei Hashmonai, Yehuda V'Shimon V'Yochanan V'Yonasan V'Elazar B'nei Matis Yahu, Sefer, B'masha Avar Leem, and he says, by the way, the five sons of the Hashmonai, Yehuda, Shimon, Yochanan, Yonasan, Elazar, the sons of Matis Yahu, they wrote a book about what happened to them, Hadoma L'Sefer Daniel, Blush and Kostim, just like Daniel, it's written in the language of the Chaldeans, which means Aramaic. You can see here, he's almost, at some level, comparing. He's comparing Megillas Antiochus to a biblical book, right? He compares it to Daniel. It's written in Aramaic. And actually, believe it or not, Rav Sadia Gaon wrote a translation. He wrote the translation of Megillas Antiochus into Arabic, right? Because most people at the 10th century in Babylonia were speaking Arabic rather than Aramaic. So he translated to Arabic. There are translations into Hebrew and, of course, all sorts of modern languages, Yiddish, English. Actually, if you look in the Birnbaum Machzor, they include Megillas Antiochus in it, which is really fascinating and shows how, at least in some communities, this became really prevalent. We'll look at a couple more attestations, a couple of other mentions of this tradition, of this source. So the Tosfos Rid from 13th century Italy talks about this. He says, V'chein nami, similarly, makom shenoagim likro Megillas Antiochus b'chanaka, those who have the practice of reading Megillas Antiochus on Chanukah, ain roi levari chalav, you shouldn't say a bracha on it. Mish ain shoresh chova klal. There's no root. There's no fundamental root to this obligation. It's not like the Gemara says you have to read Megillas Antiochus. So since it's such a late minhag, it's such a late practice, it doesn't have a strong root to it. Therefore, you shouldn't say a bracha. Of course, the contrast here: what mitzvah on Chanukah do we say a bracha on? Famously.
Lighting candles,
right? And the Gemara said, why are we saying a bracha? If you look at the language of the bracha, you say Asher Kidshanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu, Ladik Ner Tzol Chanukah, right? Everyone sing it in their head. So, what do you mean Hashem commanded us to light Chanukah candles? It's not in the Torah. The Torah doesn't say to light Chanukah candles. And the Gemara says, no. Well, you know, the Torah says to follow the rabbis, and the rabbis said to light Chanukah candles, right? So that's actually the classical example of saying a bracha on a mitzvah d'rabbanan is lighting Chanukah candles. But the Tosfos Rit says that does not extend to reading Megillas Antiochus. But what we see from here is there were people who certainly had the practice of reading Megillas Antiochus on Chanukah, and some people even wanted to say a bracha. Probably people were saying a bracha, and he had to tell them, actually, don't do that, because that's against halacha to say a bracha. But that means there was this common practice of people reading Megillas Antiochus to the point where they even wanted to say a bracha on it. One more early citation. This is from the Abu Dram. In the 14th century in Spain, he's interpreting. He wrote a book about a sefer about tefillah, about the siddur. So he says, "V'rabim biyad me'atim." Right, that's part of Al Nisim, how the many fell in the hands of the few Maccabeans defending ours. So he says, "Al shame." This is based on the pasuk Lo Shia b'Rabo b'Mat. Okay, but what's the story? Kihem hayu rabim. They, the Greeks, were many. Unitzachum chamisha b'nei Matisya. The five sons of Matisya defeated him. How does he know this? What's the source for this? Kamosha Mefurash, Megillas Antiochus. He says the source of this is because he can't quote the Gemara as saying that, because guess what? The Gemara doesn't talk about the five sons of Matisyahu winning the war, right? So the source, if you're trying to justify, to explain the source for Alanisim, Rabim Biyad Me'atim, you have to quote something else. So he quotes Megillas Antiochus. The other thing you might have quoted would be the Book of Maccabees. But this, according to the Abu Dram, this is a more traditional source. This is a, you know, he sees this as a better source to quote, to prove the point. And actually, I don't know if he even had access to the Book of Maccabees, because it was in Greek. So I don't know how the Abu Draham's Greek was, but he certainly could read Megillas Antiochus. Other communities have a practice of using Megillas Antiochus as well. There's an article that summarizes some of this. Mina Kafa Vikrasav, in these different Sidurim of these different Minhagim, Nidbisa HaMegillah B'Lashon HaKodesh. The Megillah was printed in Hebrew, meaning Megillas Antiochus was translated into Hebrew and printed there, Ulifanea Namar, and before they put the text of the Megillah, they said, Noagin Likros Megillas Antiochus B'Shabbos B'Mincha Achar Kaddish Tisgabel. When would you read it? Well, every Chanukah has Shabbos, at least once, right? So Shabbos Mincha, everyone in Shul, after Shabbos Mincha, after Kaddish Tisgabel, after Mincha's over, you would read Megillas Antiochus. That was the Minhag in some communities, according to their Siddur. B'tichlal ha-teimanim, Eitz Chaim, this Yemenite machzor, it says, V'yesha karm gilas antiochus b'shabbos achar haftarah. Some people did it in the morning. Not after mincha, but after the haftarah in the morning. B'sefer chaste avos, communion kila kadisha geradia. This other community, which I think is in Algeria, she yikra osa hashatz b'beis ha-knesses. Not that everyone would read it on their own, but the chazan would read it. They would have a communal reading of Megillas Antiochus, acha kriyas sefer Torah b'chovas hayom. Also in the morning, on Shabbos shuhu be'emtza yimei Chanukah. Shabbos during Chanukah, in the morning, after you read the Torah, you read the Haftarah, you have that some sort of chazan who reads Megillas Antiochus. And the author of this article says, v'achin an hayom no'agin yotzei gradya, Algeria, likros ha-megillah b'tzibur. So this was written only 30 or so years ago. It says, even today, those from Algeria have a minhag of reading Megillas Antiochus. So this is a live practice that some communities have to read this in Hebrew translation. Presumably that was more popular. But interestingly enough, the Aramaic version has cancellation marks. And you could read it. You could learn from that as well if you wanted to. I think Rav Kapach, who published an edition of Megillas Antiochus, he said his grandfather, who like him was a Yemenite rabbi, would teach his students how to read Megillas Antiochus and how to and they used the translation, Rav Sadia Gaon's translation, into Aramaic as they would study it together. So it's just really, really interesting to see the practice, to see some sources here, a quick survey of some of the practices of reading Megillas Antiochus, both people who quote it as an important source as early as possibly the 9th century, and people talking about different practices of reading it going back almost a millennium, practices of reading it regularly in shul, even though it's not the most common practice today, certainly for many communities for a long time, including some today, Jews read Megillas Antiochus on Chanukah. And even if we're not going to read it ritually, at least we can study it and get a better appreciation for it. Before we jump into the text itself, I just want to give a quick summary of the plot, just so we all appreciate that. I guess if there are any questions, if people have questions that are time sensitive or urgent, you can ask that now, but we'll have some time at the end as well. So let's just summarize outside the basic plot of the story. It talks about Megillas. It's called Megillas Antiochus because it starts by describing the king Antiochus, Antiochus, who was very powerful. He built all these cities. He had these generals and underlings, and he decides to attack Jerusalem because the Jews aren't following the laws and they want to rebel. So he says, let's destroy them. Let's stop their observance. And he makes decrees against observances, specific observances, Mila, circumcision, Shabbos observance, and Rosh Chodesh, which is an interesting triplet. He sends his general Nicanor to fight this war. After conquering Yerushalayim, he goes and slaughters a pig in the Beis HaMikdash, smears its blood all over the place, defiling the temple. And in response, one of the sons of Matthisio, Yochanan ben Matthisio, hears about this, and he uses a little bit of trickery. He hides a knife on him, and he gets a one-on-one meeting with Nicanor and stabs him to death. And then there's a war. The Maccabees defeat thousands of enemies, and to celebrate their victory, this round, there's three rounds, to celebrate their victory, they put up a big menorah and a big column saying, Maccabee, destroyer of tyrants. So that was round one. Round two, Antiochus hears about this. He sends his other general, Bagris, the evil Bagris, to fight them. And he, again, reinforces these edicts, these rules against circumcision, Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh. And this really was a form of persecution. And some Jews stood up to this and didn't follow the decree. So one woman actually circumcised her baby against the rule, against the law. And tragically, because she knew she was going to be killed, both she and her newborn baby, she took baby up on a bridge and threw the baby off and jumped off herself because she knew she was going to be killed by the soldiers who were persecuting her for what she did. And another group of Jews were keeping Shabbos in a cave. If you've heard the story about playing dreidel in a cave and then pretending to learn Torah. So this is not about learning Torah. This version is about keeping Shabbos in a cave because, you know, if you're on the street, people are going to expect you to be Mechallel Shabbos. You hide out in a cave, you can keep Shabbos. But a bunch of Greek soldiers pass by and see these Jews in a cave. They say, oh, come out. Let's do some Chillel Shabbos together. Let's desecrate the Sabbath together. And they said no. And they took a bunch of wood and burned and burned the entrance to the cave, and all the Jews inside died. So again, another case of martyrdom, following following the Torah, even as they were being killed. And again, after this, the five sons of Matisyahu fought back. They fought back. They pushed. They were very successful. And King Bagrus goes back to Antiochus and says, I can't fight against them. I need a bigger army. So he gets a bigger army. He gets a bigger army. He marches back, again, attacks Yerushalayim, attacks the walls, goes after the temple. And then, again, the five sons of Matisyahu fight back. They fight valiantly, but Judah Maccabee dies. And he's replaced, interestingly, by his father. So Judah Maccabee seems to have been the leader of the group. He dies first. This is different than all other versions of the story. He dies first and was replaced by Matisyahu, who steps in for his son. And he blesses all his children. He tells them, here's why we're going to win. We resemble all these biblical characters. In the end, Elazar, one of the other sons, was in charge. The reinforced army that Antiochus brought had armored elephants. That was part of his army. So Elazar, one of the five Maccabee sons, Elazar was in charge of fighting against the elephants. And he also died tragically, but also sort of hilariously. He ended up swallowed in elephant dung. My daughters enjoyed this detail a little bit. But so he died, and they finally found his body after that being a little difficult. But in the end, the Hasmoneans defeat their enemies. They hang some of them. They kill the general Bagrus. And even Antiochus, who I guess was on site overseeing this, he was so embarrassed, he tried to run away on a ship. Everyone kept calling him, you know, the runaway, because he's so scared he ran away. And then he himself jumped off the boat. Then at the end, after the war, the Hashmonaim re-enter the sanctuary, rebuild it, cleanse it of impurities. They found one jug of oil. This story we've heard of, only enough for one night. It lasted eight nights in a miracle. And that's why we keep Hanukkah today, a piece at the end about how we feast and we rejoice on Hanukkah like a biblical holiday. No mourning or fasting, but also no prohibition against work. And then at the end, there are some different versions of the text, especially at the end. Some versions say that the Hashmonaim ruled for another 206 years. We'll see that'll be important in a bit, until the destruction of the temple. And this holiday is kept for 8 days every year, starting on the 25th of Kislev. That's the outside summary. But let's jump inside, and we can really appreciate some of the details a lot better if we look at the text inside, which everyone can hopefully see now. Notice the Aramaic on one side and the English on the other. The Aramaic text was compiled by Menachem Tzvi Kadari. He took maybe about 10 or so manuscripts, different manuscripts of the Aramaic, and put them together as, you know, with his best reconstruction. And the English translation is by J.C. Reeves. I think on the other handout, which you all should have access to, there's a link to it online. You can get both the Aramaic, some version of the Aramaic text, and the Reeves translation online. But we're doing it together here, so we'll work with this. So it'll be really interesting. We're going to try to pick up on certain themes that literary themes in Megillas Antiochus that'll get us a better sense of what the Megillah is doing. Again, we have the basic storyline. The basic version, the basic idea is to tell the story of what happened, both the war and the miracle of the oil at the end, and as the basis for this holiday, right?
Can you enlarge the text?
Sorry?
Can you enlarge the text?
Not really, because if I enlarge it too much, that will then there won't be space to see both the Hebrew and Aramaic. So I think I can enlarge it a bit, but there's a real limit on this. So give me one second. I think this is the, let me make it a drop bigger like this. Hopefully my computer is able to manage with this. I think this is the, this, let's try one more time if this works.
This is not in the chat.
Okay. Can people see the, this is on the shared screen. Yes. Not in the chat.
Are we supposed to have this?
You're not supposed to have this as a separate file, because that would be a copyright infringement. But again, you can access this source on the link on the other handout, or you can follow on the shared screen. But I can't send out a file that has the entire, I can't send out a file with the entire translation, because that would be copyright infringement. Okay, so let's jump into the text here. And I'll read the Aramaic, but again, you can follow with the English either on the same shared screen or on the link on the handout at the top, towards the top of the handout, if you prefer to find that link there to the webpage. Vahava biome Antiochus, Malcha diavan. Right? So this is, and it was in the days of Antiochus, king of Greece. What does this language is very interesting because it echoes, I think it echoes very clearly, Vayhi bime Achashverosh. And it was in the day of Achashverosh. There's a sort of parallel here between our text and the book of Esther, Megillas Esther. Even the name is similar, right? Megillas Antiochus, Megillas Esther. Vayhi bime Achashverosh, Vahava biome Antiochus. That's the same as Vayhi bime Antiochus, just in Aramaic. The king of Greece, Malach Ravis Akifu, he was a great and powerful king, Vachasin Bishultane, and strong in his leadership. All the kings have to listen to him. He conquered many lands. Again, similar to Achashverosh, right? Achashverosh ruled from Hodu to Kush, many lands. Antiochus also conquered many lands. Umalchin Takifin Asari conquered many kings. He burned, captured and burned many of their temples. And captured their strong heroes. Who bana mid din sarab, so he built many cities, al safar yama on the coast, lemihavile leves malchu krala antuchia al shmei. He called one of those cities Antioch. So we're saying here that the city of Antioch is named after this king, Antiochus. Now we introduce his number two, v'af bagras, tinyane, his number two, bagras, bana le medin, so he also built a city, uchransa, likivle, in parallel, ukrali medinas bagras, and he named it the city of Bagras. We'll see these names of places that will be interesting in terms of dating the book, in terms of trying to figure out exactly when this was written. There'll be different views. One of the things that's interesting is talking about these different cities. Okay, and then another important detail here at line number five. Bishnas Asrin Vislas Shnim Lamalchuse. In the 23rd year of his kingship, he Shnas Masan Uslas Asar Shnin. That's 213 years, Levinyan Beis Alaka, that after the Beis HaMikdash had been built, Dich Shavian Poi LeMesach Yerushalayim, he decided to go to Yerushalayim. So just keep in mind these numbers, the year 23, the 23rd year of his reign, that'll be important also. And he goes towards Yerushalayim, Anev Amar LeHadavroi, he says to those who are with him, Halo Yad Isun Amad Yehudai Div Yehud, don't you know about these Jews in Yehud? Yehud is Yehuda, the area of Yehuda. In Israel, don't you know about them? Benasana lela kana lo palchin, that they don't worship our gods. Benimusana la avdin, and they don't keep our laws. Vidase malka shavkin lemeva daseon, and they abandon. Reshak is to leave. They leave aside the laws of our king in order to keep their laws. The av enun misavrin liyom tvar malchaya b'shiltonaya. They're just waiting for the day of the destruction of kings. The Amrin Emasai Yimloch Alana Malkana. When will our king rule over us? The Nishlo Biyama Uviabeshtan rule over sea and land. The whole Alma Yismasar Biyadana. And the whole earth will be given to our hands. They're waiting for some sort of messianic era where their king will take charge and they'll have control over the whole world. Leis Revus Malchusa Lemishvak Elaine. The king shouldn't have the wish of keeping these people apeara on earth. And instead, Ka'an, now, Esom and Esaka Leon, let's go come upon them. Univato minhom kiyama digzara leon shabasa viyarcha umahuta. Let's undo all of their religious commitments, all of their covenants or their promises, which are Shabbos. Shabbat, Shabbos, Yarcha, Yarach being the moon, Rosh Chodesh, and Mahulta, Mila. So just listen to the language here. What does this language remind you of? This sounds very similar to what the advisors of Achashverosh said, right? Or especially Haman, right? What does Haman say? He says, Dasei HaMelech Einam Osim. They don't keep the laws, the das of the king. If you look at the end of line six, that's exactly what Antiochus says. Dasei Malcha Shavkin, they're leaving aside, they're not keeping the laws of the king. And what's the other thing he says, or the response is, Leis Revus Malchusa Lemishbach Elein. right? We shouldn't leave them alone. That's an exact translation of La Melech Ein Shovel Lehanicham in the Megillah, right? The king shouldn't let them be. So right here at the beginning, we see multiple times that that Megillas Antiochus is invoking, is basically quoting the Megillah of Esther, right? It's fascinating, right? You would have thought, you know, why should it have to sound like Megillas Esther? But it sounds almost exactly like the story of Megillas Esther. Sure enough, I think this is a theme both at the beginning here and several other places, especially at the end of Megillas Antiochus. It's going to be invoking and relating to, and in some sense, drawing upon Megillas Esther as well. Okay, let's keep going with the text. Just one moment. Scrolling down here. Yeah, so he says, let's go and attack them. And it says, Ushvar piskama be'enei Rav Vinoi, right? That's basically Vaitava Davar be'enei Hasarim. Right? Also, paraphrase of a pasuk in Esther. Right? Him and all his soldiers, they all were happy. They all agreed to this. So that's the plan. So Bashat, at that time, come Antiochus Malka. Antiochus got off the Shalach be'Nicanor Tinyane. He sent Nicanor, his number two, Bechel Rav, with a big army, uve'am Sagi, a big group. Ve'asali Yerushalem, he went to Jerusalem. Katalba Katla Sagi, he killed many people. Unitzav Tzilma Bevesa de Makdash. So he put up an idol in the Beis HaMikdash. Be'asra Diamar El Yisrael Lavdoi Nivyaya Tamana Shri Shinti Alam. In the place where the God of Israel told his prophets, this is where my Shechina, this is where my dwelling place will be forever. And instead of Hashem's dwelling place being there, they replace that concept with putting idols in the Beis HaMikdash. Terrible. And even worse, Beis Zimna Nechasu Chazira. He slaughtered a chazir, a pig, Ve'ovilu Mitmela Azrasa Dekutch, and he brought its blood into the Azara, into the temple courtyard. Of course, what's supposed to happen in the temple courtyard is you bring kosher animals as korbanos, right? You shecht a sheep or a goat or a ox or a bird, right? Kosher animals, and you put the blood on the Mikdash. But to take a non-kosher animal, not just any non-kosher animal, the pig, the most famously non-kosher animal, and put its blood all over the base of Mikdash, that's meant to defile it. That's meant to offend the Jews. He did the worst possible thing aside from killing everyone, also defiling the base HaMikdash. So what happened? Yochanan bar Matisya. Yochanan ben Matisya heard about this. Yes, Piskimaya Elaine. He heard about these things. Ismali Ragaz Vechema. He's filled with anger. Right? Again, that's that phrase, I think, is also similar to a line in the Megillah about Vayimale Haman Chema. The word Chema there is a bit of a hint. Utsleiman Poi Ishtane. His face changed in look. Ismalich Bilibe Malamevan Al Tanai. He's thinking, what should I do? I'm so upset. What am I going to do about this? And Beidayin, we're at 14 now. Beidayin, then Yochanan bar Matisya Avadai Charba Zarsin Urchei Upusya, this very small little knife he made for himself. And he stuck it under his clothes. Yerushalayim, he went to Jerusalem. Vikam Bisra, right? He didn't live in Jerusalem. He lived right outside. Vikam Bisra Karta. He went to the gate. Ve'amar l'taraya v'natorai. He went to the guardians of the gate of the Beis HaMikdash. He says, Ana Yochanan bar Matisya kana Yehud. I'm Yochanan son of Matisya, a Kohen from Yehuda. Aseisu l'meal kudam Nicanor. I'd like to meet with Nicanor, your general. And so what happened? Eidayin alin taraya v'torin. These guards say, Ve'amrin le'le Nicanor, kana rabba, Yehud, kaim besara, ve'amar lehon oliegul. So they go and they tell Nicanor, there's some big Kohen waiting for you. And he says, let him come in. By the way, notice more resonances of the Megillah, right? A bit of a different scenario. But remember, when Haman comes to the king, and the Vayomar HaMelech Yavo, right? Vamar Lahon Ulyeul, let him in. Basically a translation of that line from Megillas Esther. He lets him in. And what happens? Eitan Yochanan Hu'al Kadam Nicanor. He comes in before Nicanor. Ani Nicanor Vamar Yochanan. Antu Chad Min Marodaya. Dim Radu Malchaya. What are you doing here? You're one of those rebels. You're trying to fight. You don't want the well-being of my king of Antiochus. You're trying to rebel, aren't you? What are you doing here? Ane Yochanan kudam Nicanor be'amar. Yochanan responds to Nicanor. He says, Ke'ana seisi kudam achlemevan ma'ati atbay. No, I changed my mind. I came here to do exactly what you want. I'm here to do your will. I'm submitting myself to you. I'm on your team now. Help me out. And at least listen to me. Ane Nicanor be'amar le'yochanan. He says to him, Well, if you want to do my will, here's what you can do. Sav chuzira, take a pig, unchase litzilma, and sacrifice the pig to the idol, right? He's basically, this is like a loyalty test, right? He says, if you're saying you're loyal to me, well, the best way to prove that you've given up on your Judean ways is shecht a chazer to my tzelem, to say it in Yiddish, which is basically the same as Hebrew, right? Slaughter this pig in front of the idol. And what? How will I reward you? And listen to this closely. How will I reward you for doing that? The albashinach, I will dress you up, levusha de bachusa, with the king's clothing. The arkivinach, al susaya de malka, and I'll have you ride on the king's horse. Ukechad min rachmei malka tevi, and you'll be like one of the friends of the king. Right? This again, invoking, if you know Megillas Esther, invoking the reward that the king there, that King Ahasuerus says will happen to the one who wants to do the well-being of the king, or the king wants them to do well. They'll dress them up, they'll put them on a horse, they'll call out, this is what's done to the person the king likes. So the uchneim of Piskama, when he said the word, Asvei Yochanan responds, Amar Mari Anadachel Min Bnei Yisrael, I'm scared of my fellow Jews. Till Yishmael Diavadis came, they're going to hear that I slaughtered a pig to an idol. They'll stone me. They'll kill me. Kan Yipkun call an Ashmin Kudama. Let everyone leave the room. Empty out. We'll just tell my Yechamun Beis Yisrael. Just leave me and you here. We'll be the only one to know about it. You'll see I'm really loyal. I don't want anyone else here. Let's just have a one-on-one. Eidai Nikanor Hanpe call Inish Min Kadamoi. Nikanor sends out everyone out from the room, right? Hotziu call Ish Me'alai. A parallel line in the Megillas Esther, sends everyone out. What happens? Bezimna zekap Yochanan bar Matisya enoi lishmaya. Yochanan looks up to heaven. This sadart slose, because I'm ribon almai. He set his prayer. He said he davened to Hashem. V'amar elakav elakad avasai Avram Yitzchak Yisrael. Hashem and the God of my forefathers, Avram Yitzchak Yaakov. V'chein amar lo timsirinani v'itan ar lahadein. Don't give me over to this arel, to this uncircumcised Greek. Tell me a cleanani, maybe he'll kill me. Don't let that happen. If he beats me, he'll go and worship his idols. He'll say his God, his fake God, gave me over to him. Don't let that happen. Let me win. So what happened? What happened next? Line 24. Beishata, at that time, pissing, he took three steps towards Nicanor, Udikar Harba Belibe, and he stuck the sword into his heart, Ramayase Ketila Be'ezras Lekutcha. And he took him out dead. He took him out of the Azar, out of the temple courtyard, dead. And then, believe it or not, we're not going to read this inside for a bit, but Yochanan, the next thing he says, he apologizes to Hashem, I'm so sorry for killing someone in the Mikdash. You're not really supposed to have tumah, have impurity in the Mikdash, and a dead person is very tame. I apologize about that. But obviously, this is round one, and you know, this is the text that we saw inside the most. This is the great victory by Yochanan. Yochanan, not Yochanan Kohen Gadol, but Yochanan ben Matisyahu, the other Yochanan, although he's also called the Kohen Gadol here, so it's a little ambiguous, but this is a great victory by Yochanan over Nicanor, killing the general. And this, again, this was round one of victory. There were a couple of more rounds of battle, but this was a major upside here. Just look at the continuation quickly. Line 27, Uminyan Kitilaya Dikital Biomahu, the number of dead who were killed on that day, Shivin Usrain Alfin Ushvama, 27,700, Diabukton Gvar Chavre. They killed one another, but this was because of the, sort of as a result, you kill the general, and then you say this is the perfect time to destroy the army. And what happened next? Bimos Vuse, Bina Minarta, and then at their residence, right, where they lived, their moshav, they built a menorah, they built a candelabra, ukrashma makavi katla takifin. They named it, meaning they presumably put it on this menorah, Maccabee, who kills the strong, right? Presumably about the Maccabees overall, but mostly about Yochanan, who had killed Nicanor. Anyone see anything interesting about this word in the Aramaic, the word Maccabee, at the end of line 29? Does anyone notice anything interesting? I can't see hands, so if you do, just shout out. If not, I'll tell you. which is, notice the spelling of the word Maccabees.
There's no
kuf. What?
There's no
spelled with a kuf.
Oh. Right, it's a kuf, not a kuf, as I think a couple people said. So there's actually a whole debate on what the origin of the name Maccabee is, what the name Maccabee is. So the sort of one of the traditional ways of saying it is Maccabee stands for Mikamocha Vailim Hashem, Mem Kaf Beis Yud, right, based on the Pasuk. The text here, if you looked at the footnote, which I didn't provide, if you look at the footnotes, it says that the different editions, some of them spell it with a kuf and some spell it with a kaf. There's a whole debate as to how properly to spell it. If it's spelled with a kuf, what does Maccabee mean if it doesn't stand for Mikamocha Vailim Hashem? What's sort of the classical translation of the word Maccabee? Anyone remember?
A mallet.
Sorry?
A hammer.
A mallet or a hammer, exactly. And that comes from the word like makeves, which means to hit something. So like a hammer. So maybe it comes from that. It's also possible that it comes from the Greek. There's all these different theories, but just good keeping in mind that, you know, Maccabee may or may not be spelled with a kuf. Here in this edition, it's spelled with a kuf. And notice also they're celebrating with a menorah. Is that interesting? Does that strike people as interesting? They sort of represent themselves with a menorah. But of course, the miracle of – sorry?
What about the English translating it as minaret?
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't look into that. It's a good question. Maybe they're trying to solve the problem that I'm about to raise, which is why would they build a menorah if the miracle of the light hadn't happened yet? But I think generally we think, well, the Maccabees are about the miracle of the light for 8 days, so they symbolize themselves with a menorah. But presumably that's not what's going on here, because internally within this story, the miracle of the menorah didn't happen yet. So you could also say they're just associating themselves with the temple, generally with the Beis HaMikdash, and the menorah represents that. I assume that, I guess minarta as minaret would be taken just not to be the word menorah at all, but like some sort of, I don't know exactly how you get to, I mean, minaret, it's the same letters, right? So it's some sort of, maybe, I don't know, some other translation that seems surprising to me. But in any event, I think the straightforward translation here is menorah, and they celebrate like that. Again, there's more rounds of this, but we're running low on time. So let's jump ahead. Again, I summarized the middle parts of the story where there was more fighting, a couple of rounds, including with the elephant at the end there. And let's jump to the end here. Line 61. After the war, after the fighting, we say Basar Dina. After this, after the Jews defeated Antiochus and his armies, and this is after Antiochus had jumped off the ship. Right after that, Alu Beis Bnei Yisrael Leves Makdisha. The Bnei Yisrael returned to the temple, Uveno Tsaraya, and they built the gates, Vidakiu Beis Mikdasha, and they purified the temple, Min Katilaya, Min Sovza, from those who were dead, right, taking the dead people out, and from other impurities. So they. If you notice, the language here is very similar to in Al Anisin. Achar Kain, Ba'u Banecha Litvir Beisecha, Ufinu Es Hechalecha, Vatiaru Es Mikdashecha. Very close correlation to that line in Al Anisin to this. I assume one influenced the other. And next, Uva'u Mishcha Dezesa, they sought olive oil, Dachya, pure olive oil, La'ad Kabotzina, to light the candle, to light the menorah, V'lo Ashkachu Elohein Slochis Chada. They only found one pitcher of oil. They only found one jug of oil that was signed with the signet of the Kohen Gadol from the days of Shmuel. That's a really interesting detail they throw in. There's an interesting medrash that part of Tfilas Chana, Shmuel's mother Chana, said that, you know, my son will have descendants who will end up having all these miracles happen to them. So maybe that tradition is tied in here. From the days of Shmuel, they have this jug of oil that was pure, and they lit the candle, Kadla Kus Yom Achada, Havaba, there was only enough to light for one day, Velaka, Shemaya, Dishak, and Shmei Taman Hashem, who said his name there, Yehavba Birchasa, made a blessing, made this, a blessing of multiplication, but this oil, that Likumina Tamnia Yom, they lit it from it for 8 days, Akein Kayimu Bnei Hashmonai Hadein Kayama. Therefore, on the basis of this, the Chashmonai made this commitment, the Asrua Dein Asra, they made this prohibition, Inun Bnei Yisrael Kulon, them and all the Jewish people, they made this new prohibition, this new rule, Lo Dol Bnei Yisrael, Lemevra Dein Tamnia Yomin, Chedva Vikar. To make these 8 days, days of Chedva Vikar, happiness and celebration. La'ihudim Paisa, right? Sasam Vikar. Again, invoking, I think, the story of Megillas Esther again. And but how do they compare? Listen to this line. The Hanukkah, they made it Kiyome Moadaya, like the Moadim, like the holidays, Dichsivin Beoraisa, that are written in the Torah. That's really interesting. Why like the miracles in the Torah? Right? You think it'd say like Purim. It's not a Doraisa, it's not biblical mandated, just like Pesach or Shavuos. It would seem to be more likely to be Darabanan. Interesting line, we'll get back to that. La'blaka ba'om nehota, l'man di'aisim basriyam, to tell those who come later, are avad b'hon elokahon purkana mishmaya, that Hashem saved them from heaven. So what do you do on these 8 days? B'hon, and this is basically a quote from Megillas Tanis, the text about what you do on these days. B'hon l'alim misved, you can't have hespedim, you can't mourn, have a eulogy for the dead. You can't fast. Anyone who has some sort of promise to bring offer something to God should pay it back there. Now, in some texts, it ends here. In other versions of the text that are not in the Kadari edition, it continues. So I added in the continuation, which is only in other texts. And the print is different, as you'll obviously see here. Biram the mishpach averas pochana. However, the Chashmonaim and their children didn't make a rule to prohibit work. They didn't have the authority from the Greeks to make such a holiday. So that's why there's no prohibition against work on Hanukkah. This is trying to explain why, if it's like a biblical holiday, why is there no prohibition against work? The answer is they didn't have the authority to establish that. The Chashmonaim, their children, grandchildren, min dinadna, churban beis laka. They committed this, they were committed to this from going forward to the time of the destruction of the temple, 206 years. Very important, we'll get to in a minute, 206 years between the Chashmonaim and the destruction of the temple, according to this text. Therefore, all Jews all over, and even in exile, keep these 8 days. And this holiday shouldn't leave them, their Israelites, Kohanim, Levim, all the sages, forever. This is the ending of the text. A beautiful ending, tying together the story, both the story of the war and the miracle of the oil, to the practice today. Now, we only have about 10 minutes, so we'll try to do this last section very quickly, and then we'll take questions. Let me go back to the other handout. And the other handout, we're going to feature selections from an article by Aryeh Kasher about 40 years ago. He wrote an article on the historical background of Megillas Antiochus, because there's a lot of different theories as to when it was written. We saw earlier, a source that said that if it's from the Bahag, if it's an authentic text, it says it's from Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, at least in one manuscript. Rav Sadigon says apparently it's from the time of the Maccabees themselves, that they wrote it down. And yet it doesn't quite, there's some issues with trying to figure out the history here. So we'll try to sort this out. Different Aramaic experts tried to figure out how to date this version of Aramaic. It's not exactly the same as biblical Aramaic. It seems actually a lot closer to Uncleus's Aramaic. So Uncleus was somewhere in the first few centuries CE. So maybe it's around the time of Uncleus that this was written. Let's look at the approach of Aryeh Kasher, which I think will be very interesting. So he says, importantly for him, the detailed stories of the scroll are not supported in ancient sources, not even in the Talmud, meaning some of the details here don't exist in any ancient source. They're not in Josephus. They're not in first book of Maccabees. They're not even in the Gemara. Some of the versions of this story seem to be very new. And he argues, had the composition really preceded that of the Babylonian Talmud, such an omission would be very difficult to credit. If Megillas Antiochus was first and it had these new details, you would have expected the Gemara to quote it. The Gemara wouldn't ignore these details if this were really first. And he says that, and he gives some details like Matisyahu fighting in the war, right? We saw Yehuda died, Matisyahu took over. There's no basis in ancient sources for that, right? That none of the accounts have that. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, he says there are some details in the Arabic version of Second Maccabees that itself relies on Sefer Yosef on that he does rely on. So he seems to agree with this Arabic text from like the 7th or 8th century. So that would be surprising if this were really such an early text. And he also argues, right, Yochanan, the role of Yochanan with killing Nicanor and the story with the pig. This also is a story we don't find elsewhere, although he mentioned that I think this is very convincing, that this story seems to be based on the story of Ehud ben Gera. Ehud ben Gera also hides a knife and kills Eglon after getting him alone, right? So it seems like, I think the argument Kasher is making is that whoever wrote Megillas Antiochus, maybe he had some details, and he also is mixing in, he's trying to elaborate and flesh out the story, and he's bringing in some of his own ideas based on the story of Ehud ben Gera. I would add maybe some details or description based on Megillas Esther. And he talks about the oil miracle, which has no roots in the Palestinian Talmudic traditions, right? The earliest source we have that talks about the miracle of the oil is the Gemara in Shabbos, the Bavli. It doesn't appear in any earlier sources. And again, if this had been a text, argues Kasher, from whatever it was, from the first century CE, you'd expect people would be quoting this. This would be a big if true, right? That source would be quoted, you'd expect. Again, even if, let's say, the Bavli had a Mesorah, had a tradition about the miracle of the oil, you'd expect it would be quoted in more places. Since it's not, probably it's the sort of thing that was at best was a tradition people had, but wasn't being written about until a bit later on. And that again would be an argument for saying that this text, Megillas Antiochus, might be later on. Now this passage we saw that they established them like miracles, like holidays written in the Torah. So we say that line's very odd, right? Because Hanukkah is not a biblical holiday; it's a rabbinic holiday, and it's not right. You don't do work on it. All sorts of other things don't line up. So. He suggests maybe it was meant to bestow religious authority on the festival, commandments, because there were people doubting them. Maybe this ties in to the campaign against the Karaites. The Karaites at the time were saying, we only keep Doraisas, we only keep things that are biblical. And you can't make up new holidays. Why are you keeping Hanukkah? How can you keep Hanukkah? That's a made up holiday. It's not in the Torah. There's no such thing as a rabbinic holiday. And maybe he's suggesting that Megillas Antiochus is partially a polemic against Karaites, saying no, you have to keep it, and it's just like a biblical holiday. A couple of other indications he has that this might not be early are, it talks about the years, right? The 23rd year of Antiochus's reign, but if you look in the historical sources, Antiochus only reigned for 11 years, so there is no 23rd year of his reign. And it talks about 206 years until the destruction of the temple, which follows from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. It's on the handout, source 8. We're not going to read it inside, but it just calculates as Masan Bashis, 206 years. So it's clear again that Megillas Antiochus is drawing from the Gemara, because it's after the Gemara, and it's drawing, and it's at a time of a Karaite polemic. Another indication he has is the cities of Antioch and Bagris. We're not going to go into the details, but Bagris, the name seems to be based on an Arabic pronunciation of a Latin word. So you want to say it must be in a time and place where people spoke Arabic. And that's why he concludes that it was probably written not before the second half of the 8th century. And that's why we see accounts of it, you know, in the 9th century, the 10th century. But it's based on the Gemara. It's responding to the Karaites. It seems to know Arabic. And that's why he wants to date it to the 8th century. A fascinating theory that someone raised recently, Yehuda Seewald, who's sort of an independent academic or semi-academic in Bnei Brak, he wrote an article about in Chitzei Giborim, which is like a Haredi semi-academic journal, a fascinating journal. So he wrote an article suggesting that Rav Sadyagon didn't just translate the Sefer Hashmonaim and write an introduction to it, which we know, and we actually have that text, and I had an article here, source number 9, is an article summarizing it. But Rabbi Seewald suggests that maybe Megillas Antiochus wasn't just translated by Unculus. It wasn't just, Unculus didn't just, sorry, by Rav Sadyagon. Rav Sadyagon didn't just translate Megillas Tanis and say that everyone should read it, but also maybe it was transmitted orally beforehand. Maybe it was formulated early on and passed on orally, just like all sorts of other things were passed on orally. The Mishnah was transmitted orally, so maybe Megillas Tanis was also transmitted orally. Maybe Rav Sadigon was the first person to write down as a text Megillas Antiochus. Shebira mitochem esoros hashonos as hanusach hanira be'enav. Maybe he sort of figured out the best nusach based on the earlier traditions that he knew. He wrote it down. Pisco, he broke it up into psukim. Behosif lo ta'amim, and he gave it a trop. He gave it a cantillation. Ka'amur gam tirgin arvis umavu. He also translated it to Arabic and wrote an introduction. So this suggestion by Sewald is, it sort of takes it to another, a next level, right? Not just that this text was composed in the Gaonic period, but maybe it was actually composed by Rav Sadigon himself. And again, not out of nowhere. It's based on a tradition, based on a Masorah that was never quite written down. And Rav Sadigon came and wrote it down and made a text out of it and popularized the text and translated the text. So maybe that's the history. Again, we don't know for sure, but there seem to be many indications that this work was written only in the Gaonic period, but maybe it's based on earlier traditions, and maybe it actually was written down by Rav Sadigon. To summarize, we have this fascinating text read in Hebrew and Aramaic in different communities throughout history, translated into many languages in many Sidurim or Machzorim. And looking at the text, it's really a fascinating story. It seems to draw on Megillas Esther. It seems to draw on other things too, the story with Ehud ben Gera. There are other themes also. If we had more time, Daniel is also paraphrased in a few places. But given some of the historical details are sort of novel here, they don't really fit with other accounts. And there are other indications, both that and the fact that it seems to know Arabic and it seems to be polemicizing about keeping Hanukkah. All these would seem to indicate that it's from the Gaonic period and maybe even by Rav Sadigon himself. Happy to take questions or discussion now. It's really a fascinating text. We should all know. I think we should all have some exposure to. So I guess now we all do. Maybe, you know, if you have some time, print out the Hebrew, Aramaic, English, some edition of it, and read it over Hanukkah. It might be a nice, maybe even on Shabbos, you know, some light reading about how Jews fight back or fought back in the time of Antiochus. Any questions or discussion or thoughts?
A question. It doesn't mention the civil war between the Hellenized Jews and the Maccabees. Where does that come from?
Great. Yeah. And sorry, I didn't see who asked that question. Who was that?
Oh, it's Lauren Blatt.
Lauren. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So for reasons of time, I didn't have a chance to talk about this, but there are some similarities and some differences between this and the first book of Maccabees. One of the major differences is precisely that. Is this presents all the Jews as on the side of the Maccabees, right? All the Jews were fighting back against the persecution, either fighting the war or martyring themselves. Whereas we know from Megillas Antiochus that, yeah, there was actually, you know, a sort of civil war. Some of the Jews wanted to Hellenize, right? They wanted to become like the Greeks. And in fact, that's sort of what the war was about. The war was primarily between Jews who wanted to Hellenize and Jews who didn't. Whereas this takes the story to be totally different. It's about a king and his army persecuting the Jews, and all the Jews are on one side, right? You could argue that that's another indication that this is a bit later, and it's sort of a cleaned up version of the story. All the Jews are on the good team, right? You might say that's another indication that this is a bit of a later work. It's certainly a very important discrepancy between this and what we know from the Book of Maccabees and other historical documents. Yeah.
The question. And when was this text hidden? I never heard about that.
When was this text?
Was hidden all the time. I mean, just was discovered lately? I never heard about Megillat Antiochus.
Yes, so I think we saw how it hasn't been hidden. Jews have been translating it, reading it, putting it in their machzorim for the last, at least 1,100 years. But it's fallen out of practice. Most Jewish communities don't read it. And it's not part of the curriculum in most places. So it's hidden in full sight.
But why? Why only the Sfaradim knew about that? The Ashkenazim don't know nothing about that.
Well, no, so Ashkenazim know about it too. There are Yiddish translations of Megillas Antiochus, and there are, I mean, Italy's, you know, sort of Ashkenazi, and they had a practice to read it, and it's in the Birnbaum Boxer. That's very Ashkenazi. So it does exist in some places, but I think, and you know, you would have thought, I mean, I'm a bit with you here, Chaim. I think, like, you would think we don't have any Hebrew or Aramaic text telling the story in detail. I mean, the Gemara is pretty quick. Even the Rambam doesn't go into too much detail. Al-Nisim doesn't. You'd think this would be a perfect opportunity to have a text that goes into more detail. So I don't know. I'm with you. I think we should all study it more. I think, you know, especially given the conclusion we reached that it's not a book of Tanakh, certainly. It's not probably not from classical Chazal. It's from the Gaonic period. We don't exactly know who authored it for sure. So it doesn't have the same authority as something like the Gemara or the Rambam. So I think that's why it's sort of not seen as central. But I think basically you have two types of people. People who read the historical sources about Hanukkah and people who read the Frum sources about Hanukkah. And somehow Megillas Antiochus is sort of fell between the cracks, right? It's not really on either side. In some places, it's still the Frum thing to do. But most places, you know, you'll read the Gemara and the Rambam and Al-Nisim, and that's enough. And you won't necessarily read Megillas Antiochus. But I'm with you. I think we should be more aware of it. I think it's a fascinating and really interesting text. And I think, like, thematically, in the academic world too, by the way, there's very little treatment of it. You know, and most of the treatment is sort of dating it, figuring out when it's from, and that sort of thing. But very little analysis of the text itself, like a literary analysis of the text. I think that would, as opposed to what we're going to look at the next 2 weeks, Toldos Yeshu, there's a ton of academic writing on that for reasons you can guess.
I wonder whether the word minaret is an allusion to the Muslim minaret and implying that the menorah is the true version of the way to pray to Hashem via the menorah rather than within the minaret. An anti-Muslim polemic.
Interesting idea. The truth is, I think I'm going to be at a seminar by J.C. Reeves in a few days from now. So I'm going to try to ask him. I think it's even going to be on Hanukkah. So how could I not ask?
Where is J.C. Reeves?
I don't know where he's affiliated, but whatever. He's giving a seminar, a closed seminar that I'll be at. But so maybe I'll see if I can.
I live in a street that's called Reeves Street, so I'd really like to hear from him personally.
Okay, very interesting. I see on the chat, Jake asked, when did pig become not just unkosher but also anathema? I think there's some scholarship on this, how like there's no pig bones in parts of, you know, like ancient Israel, even though there were pig bones in their neighbors. So I think like the idea is it goes back really far. I don't know how far, you know, not finding bones, it's hard to prove that's anathema. And even being on the list of the four things that, you know, that the Torah spells out, animals not to eat, is not quite a proof of it. It's hard to prove this sort of thing, but I think there is a reasonable theory that the anathema goes way back. You know, pigs and Jews don't get along so well.
Is there? Am I on?
Yeah, Hyman.
Is this book part of any Christian canon? Because if I'm not mistaken, the Book of the Maccabees, at least certain portions of it, are part of the Christian canon, which would argue for a very late date or a relatively late date for this book versus the Book of Maccabees, for example.
Yeah, I mean, if according to the theory that this book was written down in the, in the second century BCE, one reading of Rosadigon would have it. So, well, if it was already written down so early, why didn't it make its way into the canon? I mean, one answer is that it was written in Aramaic. So, you know, there aren't really Aramaic works in the Christian canon. But it doesn't get cited.
There are Greek works.
Sorry?
There are Greek works.
Right.
That
right.
were retrofit into.
Right. Yeah. So why didn't they translate it and then include it? Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think I think among people who have examined the language and everything, the earliest date you're going to find is like first or maybe second century. And again, I think there's fairly convincing evidence that it's later than that. That is further indication that it's not very early. Any other questions or comments?
Even though it does mention the miracle of the oil, it doesn't mention the word menorah again. in that passage, which might support what you were saying, that it was appended from the Gemara and not native to whatever the original account here was.
That's interesting. Yeah. I also, we have to check the all the different manuscripts or the Qadari version, which refers to all the different, to see if maybe some of them have it. But that's interesting. It's sort of ironic. The place where you'd expect menorah, it doesn't appear. In the place where you don't expect it, you have menarta, if that means menorah, right? So that's interesting.
Do you have a theory for why a menorah would have been lit without clear symbolism given there?
Well, what doesn't say it was lit. It says they built a menorah. So I think the symbolism, there is a famous menorah built as a commemoration of a military victory. Does anyone know what I'm referring to?
Titus?
Yeah, the Arch of Titus has a big menorah as a testament to his military victory. So I don't know if it's conscious or not, but it's definitely interesting, this image of building a menorah after a victory against the Greeks, which is, sort of inverting things. Instead of losing to the Romans, you beat the Greeks, you build a big menorah to show that you won. But that was a thought I had when reading that. Or just sort of, again, assuming this is late, they already knew the Hanukkah story, even though the story didn't, internal to the story, it didn't appear yet. But everyone reading it knows, of course, this is the Hanukkah story with a menorah. So you can mention a menorah. It makes sense as a symbol, even though it doesn't make sense within the story.
I thought about the titles. The fact that they have the menorah is to show the Jews what you did today. Greeks, we were able to overcome the difficulties.
Mm-hmm. And this is the other way. This is the same thing in reverse, right?
Yeah, I believe that that's the reason the menorah is there.
Very nice.
No, I mean, I might be wrong. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you for your suggestion. Any other comments or thoughts? Okay, so thank you, everyone, and looking forward to seeing you the next couple weeks when we move to Toldos Yeshu.
Thank you. Happy Hanukkah, everyone.
I posted in the chat a link to our Hanukkah series, so if you're interested in checking out any other classes, please click on the link, and as always, you're welcome to contact me with any questions or anything I can help you with at info@torahinmotion.org. Thank you so much, Dr. Zokir. We'll see you here same time next week. All the best, everyone. Happy Hanukkah. Bye-bye.
Happy Hanukkah.
Stay well.